Welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. On Natural Velvet's new album, Mirror to Make You, the band puts forth female fury. Today on the podcast, Natural Velvet bassist and singer Corinne Osterman and guitarist Kim Tay come in to talk about their aggressively feminine music. Corinne and Kim make up half of the alternative post-punk band, along with guitarist Spike Arriaga and drummer Greg Hatem. Mirror to Make You, the band's third LP, came out earlier this month, following 2015's She Is Me. Corinne and Kim talked about those albums, their relationships to the cities they grew up near, how identity and aesthetics shaped the band, and their very different musical educations. Here's our conversation. So you guys just had an album come out, what, 3 days ago?
Oh, God, it has been three days.
So soon. It's so exciting. June 2nd, it came out. It's available on iTunes and Bandcamp, retailers, actually, nationally and internationally for some, Amazon.co.jp,
big release, yeah. So what have the past few days been like?
It's been a lot of, you know, cleaning up everything. We had our huge show at the Auto Bar, and it was, we built a set to go with it. There were lights, so we've been kind of cleaning up from that, and also our family came into town, both of us specifically. Yeah. My parents came in from Chicago.
My mother came in from New York, actually, so we had a whole cadre of
we were also busy taking everybody out to brunch.
That is essential when the family visits. I've definitely taken my family to Golden West like every time they've
that's
come.
The place, isn't it?
It's the brunch spot. It's like the great, and it's like a cool environment to, like, you know, show the family like Baltimore's quirkiness, I guess, you
my
know?
Parents are very picky eaters, so I'm just like, all right, you can have a burger, I can still have tacos, like everything's fine.
We got the burgers and tacos all set. Yes.
And the tequila.
Oh, it's true.
So are you guys from Chicago and New York originally?
Yeah.
Yeah, where I came in from, actually, we both came in actually to school here like 8 years ago.
Yeah, in 2009.
And I'm from like upstate-ish New York, actually around the Beacon area, which is like a hot hipster spot now, which is pretty funny.
Yes, I went to Storm King last year and Zia Beacon. It was very cool. Yeah.
It's really nice there. It's crazy how that neighborhood's totally changed. It used to just be a bombed out industrial wasteland kind of spot. And now it's brunch. It's like Hamden.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
And how about Chicago?
So have you ever seen the movie Wayne's World?
Yes.
I'm from like the Aurora area.
Okay.
That's the only way I can explain it to people who aren't from Chicago. So I'm like about 45 minutes west of the city. So I never really got the full experience of Chicago City up until I was like maybe 16, 17. At that point, it was too late. I was already going to move away anyway. But yeah.
So you guys were both kind of like city adjacent a little bit.
For the most part, yes.
I mean, how did that influence you? Were you guys like, did you associate with New York and Chicago a lot, or just like wanting to get out and try something new?
You know, I particularly didn't associate with Chicago, partially because I came from a fairly strict upbringing. My parents are evangelical Christians, which is something that, you know, like we're talking evangelical Christians during the Bush era in like the Bible Belt. So things were a little bit different. They've warmed up and gotten a little bit more comfortable with me in my meanness as an adult. We'll put it that way. It was kind of rough for my teenage years. So I didn't really get to leave the house a ton.
I'm like kind of the opposite story. Like my folks, I'm like mixed race. Like my dad's Filipino Chinese and my mom's like Brazilian white, both like U.S. citizens now. But they're very, very liberal. I used to take the train even when I was like 14. I would just take the train into the city, spend a night, go to concerts, like go shopping or like hang out with my friends in parks being weird. And I was able to really, like, by myself just explore the city. It really influenced me a lot, especially the, like, punk scene, like, the music scene there and the art. I sometimes had a hard time going to, like, art galleries as an artist and feeling like I didn't belong, but I kind of just went there anyway and had a lot of fun.
I mean, isn't New York just one giant inferiority complex, like, of a city? I mean, I don't know how you don't feel that way in New York.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you're little, you kind of just like, I'm just a little kid. Like, I got my little punk belt from Hot Topic. I'm ready to party.
Right.
You know, I'm going to get a coffee from this weird coffee shop. You know, it was really fun. I still have a lot of really good friends there, and it's amazing, like, everyone who stayed, like, what they're doing now, it's really exciting stuff, from working in the music industry or working in, like, awesome DIY spaces and art galleries and everything, so, yeah.
And then, Corinne, how were you able to kind of be exposed to music or punk or weird influences if you were kind of coming up in this conservative environment?
Well, so to clarify, there is like a very specific kind of subset of evangelical Christians out there. My family was from the more like artistically based, so the idea of like, you know, glorifying God through the kind of work that you make. So my father is classically trained on French horn. He's an audio engineer. And he played synthesizer for a number of bands in the 70s, started his own in the 80s, more or less decided he hated the music industry and was done with that by the time I was born. And my mother is a ceramicist. So, you know, there is it's very interesting. I try to explain this to people. I'm like, you know, they might be in like kind of like more liberal mediums in terms of their artistic practices, but they were still, you know, very, very Christian. And that was, you know, the world that I grew up in. So my father is a Interlochen alumni, as we both are. So I went there, and that was my first real exposure to like real music making, very professionalism at a very young age. And I went for my, like, I had a painting major. It's the kind of like summer program. So it's called Interlochen Center for the Arts, and it's pretty much, it's in Interlochen, Michigan, kind of outside of Traverse City. So it's about as far north as you can go on the lower part of Michigan. The Cherry Festival is up there, and it's like really awesome. But yeah, it was one of the first times where I was really exposed to some of the most talented young people on the planet. Child prodigies were walking around, you know, children of celebrities, people who knew about like that kind of like, it's a very insular kind of like community. And I went there for a painting major, a drawing major, and then I went for advanced painting and drawing in 2007 and 2008, respectively.
So that's like before college time?
Yes.
Okay. And then, Kim, what was your early exposure to music beyond seeing those bands in New York? I mean, like, is that what made you want to get involved, or have you been playing for longer than that?
Well, it's a little bit of both, actually. I mean, I was a Asian baby that was forced to play piano. I have a lot of, like, I don't play piano anymore. I played it for 8 years, never really got far with it. But I was able to have musical training from a young age as well, in terms of like that kind of exposure where your parents want you to be able to explore a lot. I was always very artistic. I've always wanted, like, I'm an illustrator as well, and like trained as an illustrator. So I'm always taking in the art side. But there's a really rich musical tradition that my family is a part of, like not my mother and my father, but in terms of like how I consider like the extended family of like my friends, parents, and everything. When I was a kid, I went to school with a bunch of people that are involved in the Clearwater Revival and the Clearwater organization, which is an environmentalist activist organization in New York in the upper Mid-Hudson Valley, which it's a Pete Seeger's organization. He's a famous folk musician. He was part of the Weavers. And I was always exposed to music from a young age because of that. And mostly not the kind of stuff that I play now at all, but that kind of like being able to make music was really important always, and being able to have that music mean something and be more than just, you know, like rock and roll, although I do love that side.
So is Micah what brought you both to Baltimore?
Yeah, I mean, yep. In my particular case, I had trained on trombone for 9 years. It was the choice of either going to conservatory to study to be in symphony or to go and be an artist. And my mother, you know, it was kind of a choice between like my mother's practice and my father's practice. And I ended up going, screw you both, I'm going to go be a painter, like whatever, and like move 800 miles away, which whatever. I mean, that's what you do at like 17, 18. So yeah, I came out here. I think I met you, Kim, within like the first, mm-hmm. we're in the same grade. I think I met you first within like the first like couple weeks. You had a sick mohawk, dude.
Oh, yeah. I had on purpose, like, yeah, I was always the art kid. I was one of the art kids in my school. We would, like, lunch breaks, recess, gym, if I could get away from it, I would just be in the art room making work. And Micah was one of my top picks. I ended up getting in. I ended up going. I was really excited. We definitely hung out in freshman year. Us and actually Spike. We were all horrible, like, teeny, tiny teenagers doing business.
I mean, that's freshman year for everyone, right?
Exactly. But yeah, I came in for illustration. I still do that now, although to a much lesser extent, and I've always had a music side to it.
And no more mohawk.
Oh yeah, the mohawk. I wanted to make a statement, and this was during the height of that, like, Dan Deacon, like, hipster, like, lolcats, whatever, lolso random. So I shaved sunglasses and a mustache in the back of my head before I went to freshman year.
Oh my God.
And I swear to God, everyone in that class knows who I am.
Yeah, that is actually a very effective strategy for like freshman year. You don't know anyone. Yeah. Did you end up on any like Baltimore music blogs, like back of your head with the sunglasses shade?
Not yet. I think they knew I was too little to be worth anything.
So had you guys played in rock bands before?
I played in a lot. I played in bands like little baby bands since I was maybe like 14. I actually started on bass because I liked it better. And I switched to guitar because I liked it better. So I was in like one little emo band, wannabe emo band. And then I was in like a group with my friends Olivia and Nora. I think we were called SVU after the TV show. And we sang really stupid songs about like the apocalypse where the cats come and like eat everybody and like chocolate and breaking up the band. That was a big theme of our albums.
How about you, Karen?
So I actually never had like a proper rock and roll background. This is technically my first real band, which is a little terrifying being 26 and I'm still here. But I say that with love. But I played bass for maybe a couple months for my ex-boyfriend's band. Couldn't get behind it because it was always very like tokenizing, and the shows were generally garbage because nobody knew who we were. So it eventually I was just like, nah, I'm out. Like, would rather be making stuff with like people I like.
That's interesting you bring up the tokenizing thing. I mean, for people who don't know Natural Velvet, like, you two are women. There's two guys in the band. So it's obviously, like, not this tokenizing thing. It's not just the one ex, you know, non-white guy in the band. I'm curious, like, your experience of that.
I feel really spoiled by it completely. Because, I mean, like, for example, tour. It's very interesting. We've toured with a number of people, but it's always very interesting when we tour with people who are not our bandmates. Because I'm always just like, oh my God, this is basically a bunch of catty girls in the van. It's Kim and I, and then Spike and Greg. And I mean, we're talking, there's women, people of color, and also queer people in our band. So we don't have to deal with the straight white guy thing at all. It doesn't exist in our band, which
That's
is
so nice.
Amazing. And especially because tour, it's just basically like giant slumber party.
Oh my God.
But with like less sleeping bags and more beer.
Yeah, there's definitely beer involved. And a lot of Britney Spears, like seriously.
Like very serious pop records.
That is like some
records.
Of the best car music you could listen to for
Oh
sure.
Yeah, no.
It's really good.
I feel like anytime we bring it up to any, I don't know, like cis white guy, they're just like totally horror struck. They're like, oh my God, you were listening to what? I'm like, the Blackout album.
Don't you understand anything?
I think it was on the press release or the description for your new album. I think it described you guys as like queer post-punk rockers Natural Velvet. And I was curious about having the word queer in there, and what does it mean to be a queer band, and why is that something that is important to kind of lead with in that way?
Oh Lord. Okay, so in terms of queering music in general, coming in and recognizing that there are multiplicities of voices that need to be heard, not necessarily, maybe I'm not the one to speak for that because I generally fall a little bit more towards the normal spectrum on that. But just making sure that there's a dialogue and there's also space for that kind of like a queer dialogue and like kind of queering that like white, cis, heterosexual male space, especially when it comes to something as like specific as like guitar rock. Just even being a woman in that kind of a space, even, you know, a cis, potentially non-queer, whatever, kind of woman in that space. You know, it's one of those things where even just, like, being in there is enough to kind of upset the balance.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of times rock and roll is, like, very, it's cast as this thing that's very heterosexual, very heteronormative, and very white, when in fact it did not originate from that spot. It's originally American black music, and everyone was really queer in the old days. Everyone's really queer now. It's just about having that out there, because I think that there's a lot of kids and a lot of like adults who just feel like, because they're like the things they see in the public sphere are so straight-laced or are so white, that they don't feel like they belong in these spaces. Like, I know, like, I've definitely felt that before. I'm queer. I'm dating like a guy right now, so that's like a whole nother conversation that is probably, I don't know if we have to get into that. But I mean, Spike and Greg are queer. Corey's also kind of queer. We're all really queer.
Don't tell him.
Don't tell the boys. But just being open about that and being proud about it, because I feel like for so long, and especially in the climate that we were in 8 years ago and we're in again, it's so important for us to be out and proud of who we are, because you don't feel like you belong and you don't feel like you're right. And that's just not true. Like, you are right. You do belong, and you should make awesome music and awesome art.
I also think that a certain aspect of, like, queering of music comes from writing aggressively feminine music. Nothing that's, like, kind of, like, passive or, like, super, like, it can be feminine and also extremely angry. And I think that that's something that, in terms of my practice as a painter, in terms of what I think about as an academic, that's of huge interest to me.
Like, you don't have to take on something, quote unquote, traditionally masculine just to be angry or play the guitar,
yeah,
like, really loud.
There's yeah. There's a space for kind of that, like, very, like, an aggressive feminine dialogue.
It reminds me of something I've talked about with Shauna Potter from the band War on Women.
Yeah.
And she has said
we
that, like,
love them.
I mean, their music is very overtly political, but she has said, you know, content of the music aside, like, just having their band in a certain space or at a certain festival can just disrupt the norm enough that hopefully it, like, gets through to someone. And it kind of sounds like you guys are saying something similar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they had to make a statement this year about playing Vans Warped Tour, which was ultimately about, like, hey, we deserve to be there because we're going to take the space back, which is huge because, I mean, Vans Warped Tour is, like, kind of super traditional masculine space.
I'm actually working on a story about that for The Sun right
now. Oh, my God.
So look for that in the coming weeks. What was both of your experiences like at MICA, and tell me how the band formed?
Oh, my God. Okay, so my specific, I'll start with my specific experience at MICA. I came in as a, you know, somebody who's been slightly trained in the arts in that regard, ended up being a painting major. If you don't know, painting is, in terms of the dialogue surrounding painting, it's considered one of the highest arts. So as a result, it also gravitates the most douchebags. So you get a lot of like dudes in there who are like, it's very like post Jackson Pollock, like the drip as an extension of like the phallic whatever kind of thing. And so there was, you know, there were women in the program because MICA is like 75% women. But it was also a lot of the conversations that we were having and a lot of the critiques we were having were centered around kind of like a formalist language. So talking more about abstraction and more about, like, that was a really cool blob that you made versus, like, actually getting to the content of what you wanted to, like, talk about. And the people who did try to talk content within their work were, it depended on what kind of work you were making. In my case, I had a really rough go of it, partially because, I mean, I was so young. I graduated at 22. So you're not going to be making perfect work at that time. But I got reamed out by multiple professors, and probably about halfway through, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to take any more classes with male professors because I don't even want to have to explain the very basic tenets of feminism so that I can explain my work. I'm like, that's a waste of my critique time. Or we could be talking about something that's like, you know, there's like some actual depth to it. There's some meat to it, because I was talking about specifically some kind of like existentialist feminist kind of way of being. Mm-hmm. Again, talking about a specific feminine way of seeing the world. So that was the kind of stuff I was doing. And also, to be clear, I had a academic minor as a gender studies person. So, I mean, like, I'm up my own butt in that regard. Like, I'm like, you know, give me Judith Butler,
right?
Or Simone de Beauvoir, and I'll be thrilled.
Yeah. I mean, I had a similar, but actually, I had the same experience in a lot of ways, but I was an illustration major, which is also a very heavily woman-centered major in terms of the amount of people who study it. And it's also in the same regard, and this is like across the board arts issue, like not like music aside, like take a second. There's so many men that dominate the industry as well. So it's just so frustrating in a lot of ways. I mean, in the classes, it was like amazing artists. I have a lot of friends from that class that went on to do amazing stuff and are actually changing the game in illustration, which is really exciting. But it's just that same thing where you just like are working and working and working in this medium, and you get frustrated because you know that there's so many doors that are already closed just because your name is feminine, you know, or that they find out that you're a woman and they think they can pay you less. And it's just really interesting and really frustrating. I mean, I was supported by like, I was part of like a whole crew of like crazy feminist women and non-gender and men and trans folks doing illustration at that time, and I learned a lot because of it. But it's just interesting to me that still at large, it's a male-dominated space.
And still at large, like these, you know, supposedly progressive areas of like art school or rock bands or whatever, you can still encounter the same barriers over and over, or they can even be like exacerbated.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Do not get us started.
Well, I've talked about this with a lot of musicians that I've had on the podcast or interviewed for stories. I mean, do you guys run into those kind of typical stories of like, you know, they ask Greg or Spike, like the sound person asks Greg or Spike what to do instead of you two, like deferring authority and all those kind of classic ways that women in music are looked over?
Yeah, I mean, we get a little bit of that. I mean, in locally, not so much. I mean, at this point, I think people are aware that we exist, but definitely while we're on tour. Absolutely while we're on tour. Like I've definitely gotten the like stopped in the doorway. Wait, which band are you here with? Are you the singer? Yes, I also have this huge rig behind me. Let me through. It's mine.
Oh my God. There was that year that we had an 8x10 bass cab that we would take everywhere. I don't know if you know how big it is. It's about as big as that cabinet over there.
It's like the size of a refrigerator.
How much did it weigh?
It's like 110 pounds.
And me and Corey or Spike would just lug it in and just like statement.
Well, it was also at the time we had to do it because there was still such a huge like noise rock scene in Baltimore. And it was just like the most like butt rock, stupid, like whatever sounded like Nirvana and like crunch, crunch, crunch. And so we would show up with these huge amps because I'm like, all right, I mean, I got to let you know that I'm physically here, you know?
It's all about the presence.
How have you guys seen the Baltimore scene change since you formed the band?
There's significantly more diversity within the scene. That being said, we need more of it still because there's still access to space that we have because we're in a, you know, we're playing rock and roll, which is predominantly white in terms of, you know, the sound and like the generally the people who are playing it. So we have access to space that some people don't have access to. And that's something that needs to be discussed. And, you know, there has to be spaces for everyone to play and for there to be crossover. I know that when we book our shows, we aim to do, you know, make really diverse bills that also are cross genre. So that you're also getting, you know, in terms of the business side of it, too, you're also getting people with different tastes to show up. You get more people with a variety of tastes. And I also would say that most people don't have such a, like, narrow view of what they like to listen to as music. So, you know, you can put together a show with, like a full guitar band and, like, hip-hop and, like, some other stuff, like, more acoustic stuff. Like, you can have that kind of diversity here. And that's always what I thought was our strong suit as a city, but we also deserve to really, you know, when there's issues with diversity in the scene, we have to absolutely address them.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think that it's definitely changed. I feel like the face that maybe outside of Baltimore you see that's fronting music is still like Future Islands is blowing up, which is awesome. They're so
happy
sweet
for
guys.
Them.
And then Lower Dens and Beach House, of course, and Dan Deacon. And then you think, oh, those are all folks that are, they got very pale skin and all that. But then there's Abdu, Ali, and of course our label mates, Bond Street District, and TT, the artist who's like,
who's actually blowing up. She is actually blowing
TT
up.
TT was the first guest on this podcast, and she does the theme song. So
she is straight killing it.
Yeah.
I watch her on the internet, and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to put my pajama pants back on and go to bed.
I've lit up one more episode.
Good
of
for her, man.
Oh, no, she's awesome, and I'm so glad to see her, like, really get out there because it's time. I mean, she's got tunes on freaking HBO shows now. Like, yes, like, seriously excited. And, like, I mean, obviously our music is very, like, guitar crazy people music. So it's not necessarily ever going to get on an HBO show. But
hey, don't say that. That's not true.
We got it.
But that is interesting what you say about, like, the local scene versus the outward facing part of it. Because you're right. It is, like, there have been so many more bands, rappers, artists coming up in Baltimore, and they get a lot of local recognition, it seems. But you're right, the outward facing people, it's just kind of like the beach house Future Island city.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why people have trouble making that jump, but it does seem to be real. And other artists I've talked to have felt that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's real. I mean, I think that it does come from being one of the flyover cities of the East Coast. I mean, I don't think of Baltimore like that, but when you have bands that identify as DC, bands that identify as Philly, and bands that identify as New York versus Baltimore. I think people think it's smaller than it is, and like that the scene is smaller than it is, but I think the scene is really tough and really like the amount of bang for your buck. If you go to a show and like any day of the week, you're gonna see something really special and really exciting from anywhere in like in the city. Like there are some really, really amazing artists here, and I just hope y'all outside of Baltimore take a listen. Consider
talking about kind of like the diversity of booking shows, and also kind of just going back to like your Britney Spears comment. I mean, I kind of feel like it's the most outdated thing in the world to like write off entire genres. That's not how people listen to music anymore. Like everyone listens to the new Taylor Swift and Chance and Natural Velvet. Like, isn't that kind of the same listener at the end of the day?
Like, we're very, very blessed in that it's very interesting. And I can spiel about this for literally ever, so I'll only like give a little tiny tidbit. But I mean, the music industry being what it is, and with streaming being what it is these days, you know, people aren't necessarily buying physical copies and sticking to that specific genre. They're kind of cross-pollinating in terms of the genres that they're listening to. And I think it's silly to write off entire genres, especially when like certain genres are more specifically geared towards women or whatever. Or like, you know, I remember growing up, all of the kids in high school were like, I hate rap. And I'm like, you know what? I know. Well, that's also the Midwest. But I mean, like.
Or I hate rap, except for Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang's great.
Oh, my God.
And Kanye. I think Kanye was like an early crossover for the Midwesterners.
Oh, I was going to say from Chicago. Oh, yeah. Kanye's cool.
Oh, yeah.
It's cool, man.
I mean, it's cool, too, man. It's very art-oriented, too. So.
Yeah, what kind of music did you guys grow up listening to?
So again, because I came from a kind of like, how do you say, conservative background, you know, a lot of the stuff that I was really kind of exposed to in terms of rock and roll, which was the stuff that I loved, was more like psychedelic, classic rock kind of stuff. I definitely moved to Baltimore with it as a hippie with like my hair like all the way down to my butt. Shaved my head my freshman year because, of course, that's what you do at 18. But yeah, a lot of my influences when I was young was like, you know, the Jefferson Airplane, Janis Joplin. I'm trying to think. I mean, like Electric Prunes, if you want to get weird, stuff like that.
I had a pretty like intense music. I've never considered myself a music snob, but I've always been a like music nerd, if that makes any sense. Except for like, I guess baby times. I was definitely into Raffy and oldies.
I was very into Raffy too.
Yeah, he's like really good. Guys, you gotta check out this guy.
People forget he like originated the banana phone, right?
He did.
I think he did, because I vividly remember the banana phone song from when I was like three.
I remember the banana phone YouTube video, that internet 1.0 thing.
Oh, no.
Like, oh God. Like I had my friends, and we all had our little cargo shorts. This was like in middle school. It was a bad look.
Oh.
And we're like, oh, banana phone.
Yeah. Early internet was such a different time.
Oh my God. Absolutely. Yeah.
I guess like after that, I got really into like, I was an emo kid.
You're coming out as an emo kid today.
It's here. I'm here. I'm
like emo. It's okay.
I may still be an emo kid.
I mean, there's the whole like emo revival right now too. I don't know if it's truly a revival or if those bands have always been around and people are kind of getting nostalgic about them now, but there's certainly the think pieces that say that there's the emo revival.
I mean, what does the Midwest do better than emo bands?
Exactly.
Like, really. I mean, I remember just like being completely drowned in them. Granted, I was not necessarily an emo kid because like my mother would never have let me...
Oh, no.
Ever?
I was an emo kid.
I was never allowed. I remember my dad, like, I mean, granted, this isn't emo, but I remember my dad taking a copy of my, like, when I got my, like, Green Day Dookie CD and broke it in half in front of me. He's like, this is trash.
No.
Like,
that is so dramatic.
No,
but
mom,
so yeah, I'm very jealous.
When I got my Green Day Dookie CD, my mom just listened to it in the car and she was like, oh, that's interesting.
Oh my God.
I think I got my mom into heavy metal in high school, actually, like straight up.
That's quite an accomplishment.
Work.
She's like still sends me updates about the different like heavy metal guys. I was like super into like Japanese heavy metal, like specifically. I was like such a nerd. I'm not Japanese either, so it's just like it was a total tumble from emo anime, like Japanese emo, Japanese metal. But anyway, she sends me updates on this guy named Joshki, who's like a very famous hair metal guy from X Japan from the 80s. And he's still famous, and He actually worked with Paris Hilton once.
Oh, dip.
But, and she sends me updates about his life on the daily. She's like, oh, no, Yoshiki. Like, oh, his hand's hurting.
That
oh.
seems like a delightful thing to receive from a mom.
It's
I like
really
that.
Sweet.
Your mom sends me Facebook posts about flowers.
Aww.
I like Aww. That a lot.
My parents took my brother and I to Green Day in middle school when we got good grades one semester.
Oh,
that was our reward.
Because
they were into really it. We fun. Listened to a lot of alt radio, so... They were excited about
I'm
that.
I'm literally green with envy. Like, holy crap.
Green
I remember,
day with
oh,
envy.
Ding.
Horrible.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
My mom did let me go to the Korn Family Values tour with her. It was really fun.
Do you still have the concert shirt?
Yes.
Oh, good.
I do wear it.
That's priceless. So
yeah.
How did the band form?
So we started in 2012, summer of 2012, and it was partially because none of us could get jobs, like day jobs.
Mm-hmm.
It was in between junior and senior year, and it's like that kind of that magical point where nobody wants to hire you for anything.
Because they know you're about to never be able to work for 6 months?
Pretty much, yeah. So, you know, we were kind of just, I think, putzing around for the summer. I was working on my senior thesis paper, and Spike was playing with this band that was just in his basement. They had never played any gigs, save for like one house show where they covered like Crimson and Clover, and that was like pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a great house show, but those members ended up leaving. Spike was like, you know, my band's out of town, whatever. Do you want to come over and jam? And I was like, wait, hold up. You got coffee and air conditioning at your house. It's August. Let's go.
Seriously, the air conditioning.
The air conditioning over there was cranking. It was awesome. To this day, I'm like, yes, yes, please. And I remember he called you, me, and then our original drummer, Adam Jones. Like, this mm-hmm. was not, like, set up to be anything in particular.
It and was Adam Jones from the Orioles.
I know. Every single time I have to clarify, no, it is not Adam Jones from the Orioles. It is Adam Jones from Brooklyn.
Drummer Adam Jones. Random person.
Great drummer.
And he was also a MICA student and an illustrator as well. Mm-hmm. And this was never intended to be, like, a, you know, a permanent thing of any sort. And I had been playing with another band for like maybe 2 months, and we jammed, and it was tighter and way more awesome than anything I'd ever played with that other band. And I was like, well, all right, what do y'all do tomorrow?
Nothing.
Like nothing? Yeah. Okay, cool. Do y'all want to come over here and like get coffee and like jam?
Yes.
That's pretty much how it went. And then I think we were offered our first show within, I had literally, I think we had done that one practice, and I had spoken with one person. He was like, oh, I gotta fill this opening slot for a show, and I was like, okay, cool, we'll do it.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, and I remember we got to practice, we're like, oh crap, oh no. Gotta write a song.
Oops.
So that's how that turned out.
And
we've been
ago.
Doing it ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god.
I mean, would you guys consider yourself, I guess now or at that time, an ambitious band? Because it almost seems like with that first gig, you kind of like stumbled into it, but you've gone on to be really successful in Baltimore and mm-hmm. put out these albums. So would you say that has been a concerted effort on your part?
I mean, it's again coming from a family of, you know, my father is classically trained on French horn, but the rest of my extended family, they're all, you know, extremely high-functioning musicians and people who are doing really great work within the classical world and within also jazz as well. So, you know, kind of always striving for that kind of quality. I think that's always been something that we've aimed to do, but that's also, you know, comes from an art school background as well and from our individual backgrounds. You know, we've always kind of strove to give people quality.
Yeah. I mean, I think that how I think of it is just like always take the chance. Like it was fun. Like music and art are always something I consider is an essential part for most people. And like for me specifically of my life, like it's why I get up in the morning. It's why I brush my teeth. It's why I go to work, is to keep creating and also to like represent someone who's not exactly like the imagined idea of an artist creating. So whenever there's a chance, like an opportunity, we try and take it. And I feel like that's grown in, like over the first year we started, it was just kind of like, oh, well, like, yeah, let's play Battle of the Bands. Or like, oh, yeah, let's totally play that gig. I really like that band that we're opening for. Let's keep going. And then we kept going and kept going. And we got chances to record, opportunities to do like micro shows at Mobtown and then Ratscape, et cetera, la, 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 the whole story. But it's really just about like giving yourself that opportunity to believe in your work enough to let other people see it.
Yeah, and my policy has always been like, hang out long enough that they can't get rid of you. You know, like, you're stuck with me now, y'all.
Kim, that's interesting that you say, you know, it's obviously why you get up in the morning, but it's also to kind of represent someone out of the norm. I mean, do you feel a sense of responsibility in that way? And does it ever feel kind of like an undue burden?
I don't think it's undue because I think that there's so many people that have come before that have led the way. Like, there are, I mean, obviously, like Sister Rosetta Thorpe or Lady Bo, who's one of the original guitarists for Bo Diddley's band back in the old times. And obviously the greats, Janis Joplin, Jem and the Holograms, just kidding.
But it's just kidding, not kidding.
Yeah. You guys are a very glittery band as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, again, you know, again, taking over spaces that are generally like kind of masculine. Also, we just love glitter.
I freaking love glitter.
Dude, we shot that music video with the bathtub, and I'm still finding glitter in like my socks.
The bathtub was my favorite image in that video. I love, like, who doesn't want to be in a bathtub with glitter? That was great.
It was so
fun. That was hose water, and we shot that in October in an unheated warehouse, and I wanted to die.
But it worked. But yeah, I guess I think it's really important to make work because it's really important for me and it makes me feel good to write stuff. And then I also feel that there are a lot of Asian musicians and a lot of Asian American musicians out there that are making great work, a lot of it very classical or standard. But I think that making like crazy guitar howly music for weirdos is something that I think like a lot of girls shy away from because they don't think that that's like what, like pretty or like that's like what's okay. And I really want to like just stop that. And I want to help show, I want to show off and like be really cool and all that. But like, I also just want people to know, like, it doesn't matter if you don't look like a rock guy or like if like the people at Guitar Center are asked.
Oh, God, do not get me started about Guitar Center.
If you make music, make music and, like, make what kind of music you want to make. I think that's really important to me.
When you guys were younger, did you ever shy away from that? Did you ever want to kind of, you know, go for the pretty thing and, you know, appease the guys and not go for that kind of, like, weirdo thing? And if so, how did you get over it?
I mean, I'll let you go first, Kim. Do you have anything?
Right. I mean, I think like I've always been a really kooky guy. I've definitely felt a lot of like non-belonging in my life, I guess, because of like I was a chubby kid. I didn't follow the rules. I mean, like I followed the rules at school and I did a good job. So stay in school, kids. But I was like a chunky kid. I got thinner. Then I got chunky again. And being like one of like the only people that wasn't white in my school, that was just like a lot of stuff was already just like closed for me. So I honestly just felt like at that point, whatever. And also I was really lucky to grow up with like a couple, like I had friends who were into Riot Girl that were older than me and friends that were into like alternative music that wasn't Nirvana and Green Day. They were older than me when I was, like, in middle school and, like, early high school. And they were able to take me aside and be like, it's okay, Kim. You can be weird with us. And it was really exciting. But having those just, like, role models as friends really helped me to understand that it was okay that I wasn't this pretty, nice, soft thing and that I was, like, some kind of, like, weird, angular, like, mad thing instead. So because of that, I feel like a responsibility.
I think I definitely gave the like making pretty art thing a go for a second.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, granted, that's also, you know, like that's my upbringing. It was like, you know, I have been more or less trained since birth to do what I do as an artist. So to that end, like, please validate me, family. But, you know, like, so I think I definitely gave it a go. I tried making like abstract art when I was younger to appease the more formalist painters, you know, and I got really frustrated by that and then started making whatever kind of weirdo art I wanted. By the time I was like, you know, like 20, at that point I was like, you know what, I'm a wackadoodle, that's fine. And I'm also like, you know, identifying as a feminist and like really questioning these like very masculine dialogues that were happening within the art world, within the art academic world, and also within music, and starting to really think about my place as a musician within any kind of, you know, professional sphere.
So what kinds of things were you guys thinking about in putting together the new album? And tell me a little bit about it for people who haven't heard it yet.
Oh, boy.
This is the fun part.
Yeah, this is the part that I'm like definitely got memorized down at this point. So yeah, we finished She Is Me, the record, prior to Mirror to Make You, which just came out 3 days ago in September 2015. And we did a tour to go with it. And I remember getting back from tour and my entire life fell apart. I got back from tour and I got broken up with the day I got back from tour on like less than 3 hours sleep after working a full shift. For anybody who does tour, make sure you take the day after you get back from tour off. learn the lesson that I learned, and also don't get broken up with. I also like cut the tip of my finger off. I had a friend, like a childhood friend, who died, and my business that I ran tanked last year. So I was going through the ringer, and it was pretty much like the second we got done with that record. So I really had to sit there and kind of like wallow and feel it and like be locked in my room and like not go out and like really feel this rage, this very specific rage that I was feeling. And it was definitely gendered, a definitely specifically gendered kind of rage. So that more or less turned into the record that you're hearing now. You know, I remember kind of sitting there and like watching TV or whatever, just kind of like trying to calm down and like watching like high femme videos online of like Glenn Close as Cruella De Vil or like Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford in Mommy Dearest, and like really identifying with these incredibly campy, over the top like anti-divas, mm-hmm. who were so high femme, super 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 like glamorous, and also like just messing everything up for everyone else.
Oh yeah.
And they're also generally like sassy brunettes, so like I gotta feel that too, you know. But like, so really kind of identifying with that and taking real sick pleasure in like watching them like ruin the protagonist's storyline while also simultaneously having my own personal life completely melt down.
When you're in something so difficult like that, are you able to recognize like, okay, this sucks right now, but I'm going to be able to process it and get through it with my art? Or is that something that just takes, you know, looking in the rearview mirror?
In this particular case, I don't even know if I'm necessarily through it at this point. I mean, realistically speaking, like I still deal with, you know, the ghosts of everything that has happened from that. And I'm going to probably, you know, because it's a scar that you carry with you for the rest of your life kind of thing. Mm. That being said, you know, like I was never really suicidal about it, so just to clarify. So, it wasn't like within some kind of like mental health disorder kind of situation. It was more just like life sucks. I realize that it sucks. 2016 sucked for everyone. You know, and just realizing like maybe it'll be cool in the future, but maybe it won't. Like in my particular case, it's bottomed out. We're fine. Everything's mm-hmm. fine. It did get better. So cool. But at the time I was like, you know, I mean, like if it does happen, if it doesn't, whatever, you know, I still have to keep making the work.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that the album to me, I mean, the way we write is very collaborative. So
yeah, absolutely.
Mostly the lyrics and a lot of the bones. So most of the lyrics will come from Corey, almost exclusively at this point. We used to trade off a little bit, but and then most of the bones will come like through just like repetitive motions. Like I don't want to say the J-A-M word, but because we're a rock band, we're not a psych. Eh, we're a little psyche. But,
yeah, but that is like the three-letter word like a rock band cannot say.
God.
Right?
But like we'll play around with it, and then we'll like play around with stuff while we practice. Like if we have a show, we'll still like take the 10 minutes at the top of the set of our practice session and just like fiddle around and try out new stuff. And I remember when we came in after that She Is Me tour and we were talking about getting together a new album. We had a couple songs on their way already for the new work because it just happens like that for us, hopefully, in the future as well. But I just remember like a very pointed sense about the work that we were making and about the work we were about to make. We had some, I think that She Is Me was a great album and I'm really proud of it, but I think it was more of an exploration of like our sound and like the range.
And it was also our first record with our current drummer Greg. So mm-hmm. that was also, you know, refining our sound. You have to do that every single time you switch out members.
Yeah. And I just remember that there was like, it felt like a different kind of chemistry in the room. There's definitely a lot more I think we were aiming for a louder or more visceral feeling album this time.
Yeah, and I think we also were coming in with, like, this is what we're all dealing with. Let's, mm-hmm. like, this is our concept. Now let's figure out all the pieces that fits that in a way that we can talk about it three-dimensionally.
To what extent do aesthetics influence the band? I mean, you guys both have this art school background. Like, you have a very, like, campy, over-the-top look, and the you can definitely see the references you were just making, like, in the videos and everything. I mean, how do those feed into each other for you guys?
I mean, it's an extension. For me, it's an extension of my painting practice. I still paint. I have a painting studio. It's outside of my home. I'm very privileged in that way, very lucky to still be able to work as a painter and also be a musician. So the two very much are hand in hand for me. But it's also, you know, trying to, like, it's parallel to my painting practice also in a lot of ways, because I'm talking about kind of Natural Velvet is a group of people. Mm-hmm. It's a collaborative project, and we end up collaborating with other artists within the scene, and also, mm-hmm. you know, filmmakers, people who are going to mix our record. You know, these are all, like, influences that we have to deal with when we make a record. So, I mean, I would say that we're hugely influenced by aesthetics. I mean, clearly, I got a total boner for, like, very arty bands. So, like, that's cool.
I mean, I feel like it's, like, an Ouroboros or what? Is that how we say the word? I don't know. But, like, the, like, art I make and the art I think about and watch and, like, experience feeds into the music I make in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm very much obsessed with, in terms of making music, the sound as well, and, like, how the sound looks and feels and hears? Sounds?
Yeah, and creating, like, a whole world that kind of situates the work.
I think that, I mean, even Greg, although he's more of the music side, he's also very visual, and I think that for all of us, like, the visual narrative, whether it's seen or hidden in the work, is there, just in terms of, like, I know I think very visually, and I know Spike and you're very, like, we're all, like, the sound is the sound, and that's how we sound, but I feel like sounds look like things in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's next for you guys?
So we are going on tour, actually, in a couple days. You did the right thing and interviewed us before.
Yes, I've been burned by that before, like wanting to get a band on quickly and they're off for 2 months. So,
well, actually, I mean, have you ever interviewed a band when they came back from tour?
I think so. I think before and after.
Did they make any sense?
I don't know if it was mere hours after, like when you worked your shift.
Got you. Yeah. You did the right thing by asking us while we still have our brains on. We're going to come back, like, completely.
Brains are going to be outside of body.
It's exactly what's going, like, to be happening.
They're, like, on the tailgate.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, so.
And more albums in the future?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, these people are my family. I can't get rid of them. We'll figure out some kind of, like, you know, sustainable way to continue to make work, because that's, you know, ultimately what we do.
Yeah, that's definitely, like, the big goal, I think, as an artist generally, and especially as a musician in the space we are right now, where we have a baby. We had another baby, it's even bigger. And just, like, the amount of intensity is getting ramped up in a lot of ways. And who knows if, like, this is as intense as it gets. I hope it gets more intense, maybe. But and just in general, making that, like, a continued process, because making work is so important to me. And, like, being able to play live as well as record and write new work is just, like, the best feeling in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Corinne and Kim, it was great to have you in tonight. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble, a podcast spotlighting some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find past episodes, including lots with other Baltimore musicians, on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. If you do listen on iTunes, it would help us out to subscribe and give us a rating. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. We're off again next week, but we'll be back to a more regular schedule after that. Thanks again for listening. Okay.